From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And with just 6 days until the election, the presidential candidates continue to make their final bids for voters across the country. Hillary Clinton is campaigning today in the Southwest with stops in Las Vegas and in Tempe, Arizona. Donald Trump is making his way through Florida with stops in Miami, Orlando, and Pensacola. Yesterday, he spoke to a fired-up crowd in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where he reiterated his call to repeal and replace Obamacare before going on the offensive against Clinton.
Real change also means restoring honesty to our government. As you know, the FBI has reopened its investigation into Hillary Clinton. This is the biggest scandal since Watergate. And now it's been reported that there are FBI inquiries probing virtually all of Hillary Clinton's inner circle. She wants to blame everyone else.
They're chanting, lock her up, lock her up. Hillary Clinton made her own stops in Florida yesterday. In Sanford, she talked about gun violence and national security. But her main message, get out and vote.
So here's what I'm asking, please. Do everything you can between now and when the polls close to make a difference. Donald Trump's strategy is to get women to stay home, young people to stay home, people of color to stay home. That's more than half the population. But it's all part of his scorched earth campaign, and it goes against everything we stand for. So do you know the best way to stop him? By showing up and voting and getting the biggest turnout in history.
Both Bill Clinton and Tim Kaine, the vice presidential candidate, canceled their events in Des Moines, Iowa today after two fatal shootings of police in the area. The suspect, 46-year-old Scott Michael Green of Urbandale, is in custody, according to officials. He's believed to have acted alone in killing the officers in what's been described as an ambush-style attack. Sergeant Paul Parizic of the Des Moines Police Department pointed out that this is not a first for police this year.
You look around the nation, we're not the first ones that this have happened to. It's definitely something that's happened in other cities, other communities have had to deal with this. We absolutely did not think that it was going to happen here. It's always something that's in our back of our mind. We try to be as vigilant as we possibly can as we go about our business.
Joining us now from Des Moines with the latest is Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio. Clay, first of all, how did they find the suspect so quickly, and where is he now?
Well, the suspect is in custody. They released information a couple, 3 or 4 hours after the initial shootings had happened, and he was apprehended in Dallas County, which is just west of here. We should say that the shootings happened at the first one was reported of shots fired at 1:06 local time in the morning outside of near a high school in Urbandale, which is a suburb that borders Des Moines. It's a small suburb. Then 20 minutes later, another officer in Des Moines, a Des Moines police officer, was shot and killed in his patrol car. These killings happened about 2 miles apart, and these were on some major roads, but they run through some pretty heavily residential neighborhoods.
And the suspect has a bit of a history. What do we know about him?
Scott Michael Green is 46 years old. He's a white man, and one thing that has been being reported about a lot is that authorities are investigating whether the suspect in these killings is tied to a man's removal from Urbandale High School, that high school that we mentioned, from their football stadium last month after the man claimed his Confederate flag was stolen by other spectators, police and school district officials have said.
What about the two police officers who were shot and killed? What do we know about them so far?
The police officers have been identified this morning as the two police officers are Urbandale officer Justin Martin and then Des Moines police officer Anthony or Tony Bimineo. We know that Bimineo has a family and that Martin was single. And that's about all we know at this point.
And we're hearing about this as an ambush-style attack. You talked about the timing of it, but tell us more about what exactly happened.
So police responded to shots fired early this morning and found an Urbandale Police Department officer who had been shot from several agencies, had saturated after the shooting. They saturated the area, and about 20 minutes later had discovered that the Des Moines officer had also been killed. This is a quiet residential neighborhood, and it's pretty shocking. People are surprised, as you heard in the sergeant's remarks, that something like this could happen in a neighborhood, in a town, that this kind of thing is very rare. The last time that there was a police officer killed in Des Moines was in 1977 by being with shots fired. So this is a rare thing. This is surprising much of the community.
And are police still looking for anybody else who may have had something to do with this?
At the most recent press conference, police had said that this is their only suspect in the case.
All right. Well, we will keep watching for the latest developments on that. That's Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio joining us from Des Moines. Clay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. Yeah.
And we turn back to this election season. We're reminded that Black Americans cemented their right to vote 51 years ago with passage of the Voting Rights Act. In 1920, women broke down barriers to the ballot box. But homeless Americans have only done that in the last 30 years. In Los Angeles and San Francisco, there are measures on this year's ballot that could have a big impact on the homeless. And there's a renewed effort to ensure that Californians without a home at least have a vote. Stephen Cuevas from Here Now contributor KQED reports.
Billy Cunningham's been eligible to vote almost as long as he's lived in San Francisco.
I've been here over 40 years. Came to San Francisco about 10 or 11.
Cunningham, who's African-American, says not even the chance to vote for America's first Black president could move him.
Never really been into voting, just politics and none of that.
Cunningham fell on hard times a while back, was homeless for a time. Now he's living in a single-room occupancy hotel operated by Episcopal Community Services of San Francisco. He also enrolled in a civics course offered by the nonprofit.
Voting came up one day and I registered to vote in class.
Yeah, Billy became a first-time voter and I'll say this because we're the same age, very mature adult.
Catherine Powell is Billy's teacher.
And I really like the fact that Billy's a voter and is sort of spreading that enthusiasm to other students.
Powell's civics course includes discussion of voting rights, how to read an election manual, that kind of thing. It's designed for people who are homeless or, like Billy, just getting back on their feet.
Yes, a lot of people just haven't had the chance to be engaged or somehow thought that their vote wouldn't matter.
Not only does their vote matter, say advocates, but you can cast that ballot even if you have no fixed address.
So luckily, you can.
Pete White is the executive director of the LA Community Action Network, or LA CAN. He says people can list a shelter or public park where they sleep. They don't even need to be that specific.
On the voter registration affidavit, right under address, it says address or cross streets.
Volunteers recently wrapped up a 30-day voter registration project in Skid Row, a stretch of downtown home to a big concentration of shelters and other services. They went tent to tent, person to person, with clipboards and voter applications. And right up until Election Day, LA CAN is trying to locate registered voters to make sure they can vote if they want to. Voters like this man.
I'm General T.C. Timothy Clark Alexander, T.C. Alexander.
T.C. Alexander lives in a tent on the sidewalk just outside the offices of LA CAN. After he feeds his dog some lunch, we duck inside the building to get away from the street noise.
Are you interviewing now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, how long have you been out here in Skid Row?
Man, back and forth, you know, like...
A long time. Even so, Alexander rarely misses the chance to vote. When he was a kid, he joined his mom on voter registration drives across L.A. He also joined more recent demonstrations to help spur California to revise its voter eligibility rules in the 1980s.
You don't need ID to vote. Why should you have an address to vote? You have to fight for everything. And so we had to fight for that right for homeless people, excuse my chair for squeaking, the right to vote as citizens of the United States.
There's about 500,000 homeless people in the country, about 28,000 in the city of L.A. alone. And many are watching this election closely. There's a $1.2 billion bond measure on the city ballot that supporters hope will spur construction of up to 10,000 units of permanent supportive housing. And in San Francisco, voters are weighing Proposition Q. It aims to crack down on makeshift homeless encampments by requiring people to move into a shelter if space is available.
Put them in jail and make money off of them.
Right. Okay. If that's
Prop Q made for lively discussion during that civics class that Catherine Powell teaches at Episcopal Community Services. It was Billy Cunningham's first chance to consider its pros and cons.
The city does need to be cleaned up, but where are you going to put these people? There's only 4 or 5 shelters, and I know they're overcrowded. I'd rather walk over people than to have people just pushed aside and no telling what you're going to do with them.
Cunningham says he hadn't really planned to launch a one-man voter drive, but there is this friend of his, a Vietnam vet who's homeless.
I believe he prefers to live on the streets. Why, I don't know, but I believe he is a registered voter.
So maybe he'll start there. For Here and Now, I'm Stephen Cuevas in Los Angeles.
Why does someone open their wallet and support a nonprofit? Well, sometimes that nonprofit has opened their eyes. Let's step back. You may have heard of Brian Stevenson, founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, working for decades on behalf of the wrongly incarcerated, helping reverse 115 death row decisions. He told the story of several in his memoir, Just Mercy. Take Walter McMillan. Brian found audio tapes showing a witness in McMillan's murder trial actually thought McMillan was innocent, but police put him, the witness, on death row until he agreed to testify against McMillan. Brian overturned McMillan's conviction years later. His TED Talk was said to have the longest ovation in the talk's history. Then there's his new Legacy of Lynching project, documenting victims of lynching, including Raphael Coleman of Abbeville, South Carolina, who was murdered by a white mob 100 years ago. Last month, with the help of the Lynching Project, a memorial to Coleman was unveiled in a ceremony covered by WSPA News.
Loved ones hoping this memorial represents the promise to never forget or repeat that October day.
And I believe today is paving the way that change is going to come. It's not going to come overnight. It's not going to come in years, but it will come.
That last voice, Anthony Crawford, the lynching victim's great-grandson. So, Brian Stevenson has a lot on his nonprofit plate, and a recent donor stepped forward to support him. Let's find out more. Brian Stevenson joins us from Alabama. Hello.
Hello, it's great to be with you.
Nice to have you back. And also joining us is Jonathan Levine, co-managing partner at Bain Capital, perhaps you've heard of it, the investment firm co-founded by former presidential candidate Mitt Romney. And recently, through his charitable foundation, Jonathan and his wife Jeannie donated $1 million to the Equal Justice Initiative, one of the largest grants ever for that nonprofit. Jonathan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. An honor to be here.
Well, I should give you a chance to say hi to each other.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
I'm well, Jonathan. How are you?
Good.
And Jonathan, here you sit before me, a white northerner. We've got Brian, the Southern African American. How did your life intersect with his? What made you decide to fund his work?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, we're both Americans and believe in certain basic elements of justice on which the country was founded. A couple of years ago, Michael Brown, the co-founder of City Year, an organization I chair that goes into inner city schools and works on the dropout crisis.
Right. And one of the things they do, you might see the kids with their City Year jackets. They get to, you know, have summer jobs and stuff. It's a great organization.
Exactly. And every year for the holidays, he gives me an interesting book. And he had gone to law school with Brian, and he gave me Brian's book, Just Mercy. And I read it over the holidays. And I could not believe it. I think so many people imagine a very idealistic view of what the jury process looks like, how sentencing works. And when you're reading this book, you're thinking the dates are 1950, 1955. And the fact that this type of injustice still exists in the United States was devastating to me. And I immediately gave the book to my wife, who found it equally devastating. And we said, we have to do something. By the same token, Brian's work is incredibly uplifting because in the spirit of great American heroes like Thurgood Marshall, he is using the justice system to fix the justice system.
Okay, Brian Stevenson, when you get a call like that, I mean, you know, look, the Equal Justice Initiative has an annual operating budget of about $6 million. So this is all your work, 17 full-time attorneys. You don't draw a salary. And you've got this lynching project. You're trying to start a museum to recognize America's lynching history. You get this donation. You're thinking what?
Well, it's incredibly energizing. I mean, I have labored long in jails and prisons in regions where we didn't get a lot of support. I mean, I'm in a state where there is no statewide public defender system. When you stand up for condemned people, a lot of times people are angry. They're provoked by that. And so to get a call to meet someone like Jonathan and Jeannie who say, we really want to support you, it's incredibly energizing and affirming. Yeah. I mean, I've always believed that if people saw what I see on a regular basis, they would want the same things that I want. They would want things to change. I mean, if they knew that there were thousands of people who are innocent, who've been wrongly convicted and condemned to death row or to decades in prison, I absolutely believe that they would want that to be fixed. If they saw children who are 14 and 15 being housed in adult jails and prisons where they're targeted for sexual violence and abuse, and they held those children while they wept hysterically after being assaulted, they would want those things to change. And I really do believe that we need a better, more reliable justice system. And when people reinforce that, as Jonathan and Jeannie have, it's incredibly energizing.
Well, you both said a couple of things. First of all, a book a year to a friend, a great book a year to a friend is a great idea. You know, here's a book that can change your life. And Brian, staying with funding, we're reminded that you first started out of Harvard Law School at the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee. That was a group in Atlanta in 1983. And then later in the 80s, some lawyers convinced Congress to fund state-based death penalty defense organizations. They were called resource centers. 10 years later, the Republicans took control of Congress, cut that funding. That's when you turned your resource center into the nonprofit, the Equal Justice Initiative. The fact is, the government did fund organizations that could help the indigent, the poor, test their cases.
Well, they provided some funding, and I think it's important to say that the motivation for that funding was to expedite process for carrying out these executions. And you had to get local funding in order to be eligible for the federal funding. And in states like Alabama, we were never able to get state funding. And so from day one, we had to raise money to even access some of the federal dollars that could then be deployed to provide legal services to people on death row. And then, of course, when Congress shifted in the early 90s, those funds were eliminated. And once again, we were without much support to do this work. And of course, it was in that period that the execution rate skyrocketed. And the number of wrongful convictions also skyrocketed, so much so that, as you'll recall, the governor of Illinois commuted everybody's death sentence because he said, we've got more innocent people on our death row that we've identified than people that we've executed.
You were saying Americans don't see what you see. In the past couple of years, Americans are seeing more than they've ever seen about an inequity in the justice system pointed out in Justice Department reports in Flint, Michigan, for instance, a court system based on fees and earning revenue for towns rather than enacting justice. A lot of what you've been saying for decades. Well, I'm wondering, do you feel validated in the past couple of years?
Well, I do. I mean, I do think we've seen greater exposure, greater attention to these issues in the last few years, and that has unquestionably increased a call for greater reform. You know, ending mass incarceration, reducing the prison population has become a bipartisan issue. It's just been decades in the making, and we're not going to be able to solve these problems without more, I think, bold and significant reform efforts. I mean, we still have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. We are still the most punitive society on the planet. If you have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's imprisoned, you know, you've got to do a lot of things that are going to change that. And Congress, of course, can only control a very small subset of this issue. Less than 10% of the people imprisoned in America are in prisons run by the federal government. This is largely a state issue. So we're going to have to see some of that energy and some of that exposure taking place at the local level as well as in Washington.
Yeah. Jonathan Levine, we'll bring you back in again. Again, you made a very generous donation to Brian Stevenson's work after your eyes were opened. You know, some people don't like to say, my eyes were opened. You know, we all like to think of ourselves as being observant. Was that somewhat humbling for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I believe I'm as well-read as anybody, and I follow current events. And as my wife and I read this book, we were shocked by what we learned, but we're proud to have learned it. And one of the reasons that our gift received some publicity, we normally would be a little bit lower key than that, is I think it's really important to call attention to the work that Brian is doing in hopes that other people's eyes will be opened. This is an organization that literally can change the trajectory of justice in the United States with a budget of $6 million a year. The justice those people receive will never give them back their lives. It will never give them back what they've lost. But what Brian has done is, in many instances, given them some hope for a future. The impact that that has is undeniably incredible.
I think what Jonathan is saying when he talks about the impact of some of these stories is that, you know, we can relate to people when we understand the story, and if people appreciate that we're doing terrible things to people, I think they'll want to stop that.
It sounds like, Brian, if you get people who understand the bottom line, like Jonathan, involved with your work, that's key.
It is. I mean, the recession has probably as much to do with some of the reforms that we're seeing as anything, because it actually made states start to question their spending in the area of jails or prisons. And they said, oh, my God, look how much money we're spending to put people in jails or prisons who are not a threat to public safety. What do you mean 20 years in prison for simple possession of marijuana? I think it just sobered us in ways that, you know, the politics of fear and anger will lead you away from sobriety. And that's why it is encouraging when people like Jonathan give voice to these concerns.
Yeah. That's Brian Stevenson, founder of the Equal Justice Initiative. We also were speaking with Jonathan Levine, co-managing partner at Bain Capital. His personal foundation recently donated $1 million to the Equal Justice Initiative. And for more on the EJI and to see Brian's TED Talk, you can go to hearnow.org. Brian, Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great to talk with you.
Stocks on Wall Street opened lower today. Shares across Asia also fell. So did shares in Europe and Australia. And some analysts are blaming these investor jitters over a tightening in the polls in the U.S. presidential race between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy. Great to be with you.
And I guess one of the ideas here that analysts have said is that Donald Trump doing a little bit better than he has in recent weeks, and that the market is scared of that. Can you tell us?
They are.
What are they saying? Yeah.
They are. We should point out this is unusual, right? We tend to think of the markets as, you know, more friendly toward Republicans who tend to be stereotypically more friendly to business. That is not the case this time. They are very anxious about a Trump win. A lot of people think it would cause a very sharp sell-off in stocks, not just here, but around the world. You know, his rhetoric on trade, his criticism of Fed Chair Janet Yellen, and just frankly, his unpredictability are all seen as market negatives. Now, I have to say, there's not a lot of upside when you talk to people when it comes to a Hillary win. There are some concerns about her too, especially in healthcare. But she's much more of a known quantity. Investors just do not know what to expect from Trump. It scares them, and we are seeing those fears increase, especially in the last week.
All right. Well, let's talk about something in the market where there's actual data to look at right now, and that is Facebook, which announces its third quarter earnings today after the markets closed. There are very high hopes for this report. What are we expecting?
Yeah, the actual data, and I'd say one area where there's a lot of positivity, very high expectations. Analysts expect a 54% jump in revenue. That is insane. That is such a huge number. They're going to have something like 1.75 billion users. Now, you can make your own judgment about whether that's good for humanity or not, but for companies and investors, it shows that this is where we are all spending the majority of our time. So they are spending a majority of their money to try to reach us there. Facebook's mobile advertising now accounts for half of all digital ad spending in the U.S. So this thing is a monster. They've been beating expectations by a mile. And the bar is set very, very high, but it could be a boost and a positive for markets.
Quite a contrast with Twitter, which just had to sell off Vine the other day.
Yes, that's right.
Maggie, I want to ask you about one more thing in the news this week. Yum Brands, which owns KFC and Taco Bell, is spinning off its China division. It started trading on the New York Stock Exchange yesterday. You spoke with the CEO, Greg Creed, who talked about how the business of food is changing worldwide. Let's listen.
Food is no longer fuel. Food's gone from fuel to an experience worth sharing. So that means you have to be in the food experience business, not the food business. And I think that that changes your mental model rather dramatically, right? So,
what does that mean?
Yeah, I thought that was such a fascinating observation. And think about what we were just talking about, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. You see so many pictures of people with their meals. And so for a company like his, it means thinking more about presentation. He talked about packaging, where you connect with your customers and how you speak to them. You know, they had a promotion on Snapchat, he was telling me, where you could superimpose your face on a taco that had millions of people that participated. He said at one point, 1 in 6 Americans were doing this at one point during the day. So they're hoping to take that sort of conversation and connection with customers and translate it into purchases. So they're thinking more about that kind of stuff than even the menu, interestingly.
That's Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
And joining us today is Chris Doritas, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He's also been a music supervisor for a number of Hollywood films. Chris, welcome back.
Always good to be with you, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. And let's get to some of the music that you brought us today. You wanted us to hear the Australian singer-songwriter Greta Ray. This is called Drive.
Blazing street lights through the window glass. Your feet on the gas, my bonnet down. I know you're driving too fast. All the world is still. Imagery such as this is symptomatic. You can call me a fanatic. I'm an addict to what I could ever want. Some would say this is fiction, but it is not. I can get so high off the vivid picture that's occupying my mind. Do you want it? Do you want it?
Just listening to the accent, I have to say, I would be less surprised if you told me she was from Nashville than from Australia, but there you go.
It's really funny that you say that because she has listed Taylor Swift as an inspiration.
Mm.
I mean, along with Joni Mitchell and James Taylor and that sort of thing, but she's only 17 years old, and she's actually still in high school. She's finishing up high school in this town outside of Melbourne. I just recently came across her, and the way that we found out about her was she's won two songwriting competitions back to back. One in August by an Australian radio station, Triple J, and this past week she won this really prestigious songwriting competition called the Vanda Young Songwriting Competition, which was really the largest first prize for any songwriting competition in the world. $50,000 win.
Well, what do you like about her music?
Well, I mean, it's first of all, it feels great. But I think it is great songwriting skills for a young artist. I mean, she's just getting started. This is her first single.
And by the way, spoiler alert, this is not the only 17-year-old that we're going to hear from today. But our next band here is the L.A. band Dawes. They are old enough to drink. This is called As If by Design.
The stars were just the holes punched in the shoebox. A creature all the air he needs to breathe. As if every constellation was just a form of veneration. From a captor to enormous to conceive. The moonbeam like a coach.
Tell us about this one.
Well, Dawes is fronted by this guy, Taylor Goldsmith. He's the main songwriter and singer of the band, and he first came to my attention through an L.A. band called Simon Dawes, and now they're just Dawes.
Simon left.
Yes, Simon left. Actually, he did leave. Simon is the middle name of Blake Mills, who did leave, and he went on to become a red-hot record producer. He got a Grammy nomination this past year for producing the Alabama Shakes album. He's doing John Legend. And he's produced this album with his old friends. And this track in particular, I think, is really cool. It finishes up the album, and it's sort of a, I don't know, it's just a rollicking good time. I don't know if you could hear the piano work on this particular track, but it's this guy, Lee Pardini, who's their new keyboardist. And just the joyous abandon in this performance is what captivates me.
The boat All right, well, up next, we've got the Long Island, New York group, the Lemon Twigs. This is Baby Baby. Okay, we get to do the thing that happens probably every 4 to 5 months in a DJ session, which is I make the comparison that I hate to make with the Beatles, but there is a little bit of a Beatlesy sound in there.
You know, you're right. I mean, I share that idea. And I, for me, it was like the Kinks, early David Bowie. It has that sort of Baroque flourish that a lot of 60s bands, including the Beatles, had, right? But there's this freshness that feels somewhat like MGMT. It's definitely not, you know, a dinosaur sound. It's a very current sound. But they're laying in harpsichord and tack piano and xylophone and all these little surprises and nooks and crannies in the music that are, it's just a joy to listen to it.
Well, and in fact, one of their songs was featured in the Fox sitcom New Girl just this week. They were tweeting about that. But what else should we know about the Lemon Twigs?
Well, the album itself is a roller coaster ride. And then when you find out that they're brothers from Long Island, New York, 17 and 19 years old, respectively, I mean, it's for me, it's the finest debut of the year so far.
All right, well, on to the next one, the Los Angeles funk group Wolfpack. This is called Aunt Leslie.
The color TV, filter the truth through you to me. What's not to trust is just your family.
Now, this group performed at Bonnaroo earlier this year. What else should we know about them?
Well, they originally came to our attention when they were back in Michigan. They met at the University of Michigan. And they wanted to do this thing that was sort of a rhythm section, not unlike, you remember the Funk Brothers or
yeah.
the Muscle Shoals or Wrecking Crew rhythm sections that backed up all these hits. The Funk Brothers did all the Motown hits, for example, My Girl and Heard It Through the Grapevine. Wolfpack patterned their band out of that. They wanted to be kind of a really cool rhythm section. And they have this rotating cast of vocalists and guest instrumentalists that come into the band. And it's a very democratic thing. The new album, The Beautiful Game, features this guy that we just heard, Antoine Stanley, who they met when they were up in Michigan. But now they're based here in Los Angeles, and they're becoming really part of the vibrant Los Angeles music scene right now.
All right, well, we have time for one more, Chris Doritos, and you wanted us to hear the new Leonard Cohen album. This is You Want It Darker.
Magnified, sanctified be thy holy name. Vilified, crucified in the human frame. A million candles burning for the help that never came. You want it darker. I'm ready, my lord.
Fair to say his voice has dropped, I think, Chris.
Well, it's funny. We've been featuring these 17-year-old musicians, and now we have a man who just turned 82 years old, releasing arguably one of the best, if not the best, albums of his entire career. What really struck me when I first heard this lead-off single was the haunting all-male choir that backs him up. Any Leonard Cohen fan will know that he's always been fond of having a couple of female backup singers because they felt like they made his voice sound less depressing. This album was produced by his son, Adam Cohen, and Adam had the brilliant idea, well, why don't we kind of flip this on its, you know, side a little bit? It's sort of a look back, in a way, at a stellar career. And to have this sort of sanctified sound of these singers backing him up. It's a choir that comes from Montreal, from the synagogue that Leonard grew up in. So there's a nice touchstone to the album because of that.
Well, some great music. Very eclectic mix today. Old and young. Chris DeRitas, DJ at KCRW. Thanks so much, as always.
Thanks, Jeremy. See you again.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify and search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Today, officials at the company building the Dakota Access Pipeline said they're not aware of any plan to reroute it. Yesterday, President Obama said the Army Corps of Engineers was examining a new route to accommodate sacred lands of Native American tribes. As you no doubt know, members of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe say the pipeline will disturb sacred lands and pollute waterways. They've launched a huge protest. Meanwhile, a pipeline explosion in Shelby County, Alabama, that killed a worker when a track hoe hit a gas line, put another pipeline in the news for the second time. The Colonial Pipeline had a huge spill just months ago. The recent accident will disrupt the flow of gas to millions of people along the East Coast. Pipelines. Why don't we hear about them till something goes wrong? Ewan Alexander is dean of the School of Engineering at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Dr. Alexander, welcome.
Thank you.
And you see this as what? I mean, a lot of people, environmentalists, see this as another reason not to construct more pipelines like the one in North Dakota. People in the industry, of course, see it as dollars, you know, flying into the air as it remains broken until Saturday the company says it might have it back together. How do you see it?
I think it's important for us to remember that pipelines that carry petroleum, gas, are as important as the electricity grid, our sewer networks, and so on, particularly for petroleum, because really, it's, if you think about it, it's kind of the part of the lifeblood of the country. And regardless of your overall opinion about putting in more pipelines and so on, we rely very heavily in this country on distribution of petroleum products.
It's there, and we have to use it now. So tell us more about this pipeline. More than 5,000 miles long. Carries a lot of gas.
It does. It has a daily average of about 100 million gallons of gasoline, home heating oil, aviation fuel, and other petroleum products. And it starts off in Texas and terminates in the port of New York and New Jersey. Travels through 11 states, and there are even branches to Tennessee.
Yeah. Well, it's had problems before. In 1996, a main line ruptured in South Carolina. A huge spillage then. It paid a record $34 million fine to the EPA because of environmental damage that several subsequent spills caused. And then just as recently as September 9th, there was a spill. We remember the huge lines at the pump then, a shortage of fuel in Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, the southeastern states. What's your sense of the safety of the pipeline?
Well, I think that, as with most large-scale things, there's always some risk of things not going the way you want as they age. And, this is part of a major set of infrastructure of pipelines and electricity grid networks that deliver power and energy to us across the country that will suffer from aging infrastructure problems, despite the fact that efforts are made to maintain them. I mean, we talk a lot about resilience today of our infrastructure to disruption. And I think that that's recognized in the government in Washington, D.C., and, of course, by all major practitioners of energy transmission and power transmission, because it's the number one important thing for us.
I often think that I don't expect my refrigerator to last decades, but we do expect things like pipelines.
Yes, but should we? And certainly, the companies that operate them are obviously very aware of this. It's why they have crews working on them, maintaining them, and testing them. But if you consider, we have hundreds of thousands of miles of these pipelines. It's the same with train tracks. You can inspect them. It's difficult sometimes to predict where they're going to fail. And that's why you have maintenance crews, and that's why you have renewal programs and so on.
And in this case, it was a crew that actually hit a line, reportedly.
Yeah, that was very unfortunate. Yeah. That was very tragic.
Tragic. But it also seems to underscore the points of the protesters at the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota who say, you know, a pipeline can rupture, will damage their land, maybe harm their drinking water if there's spillage. But on the other side, the company says it is safer than trucks and trains, which we've also seen terrible accidents there.
That's right. I mean, you know, we have accidents on our highway. There are occasionally accidents on railroads for a variety of different reasons. And it's not an option for us to altogether stop transporting petroleum from point A to point B.
Yeah. This was human error, as you say, tragically. But as an engineer, what's the one thing that you worry about in the entire pipe system across the U.S. that, you know, many of us never think about?
Well, I think it goes back to my original point that pipelines and things like the electricity grid are of concern. You know, we have major events like hurricanes that are often close to distribution systems for petroleum and electricity and so on. What kind of damage gets done? How long, how quickly is it, does it take you to bounce back from it? And it just goes back to the general question of resilience of our lifeline-type infrastructure. We have a pretty sophisticated network of delivery of power in various forms, from liquid power and gasoline to electrons and electricity. And we don't think about it. We flick a switch, we expect the lights to go on. We go to a gas station, we expect to be able to fill up. And so we need to be cognizant of the fact that when you've got a pipeline system that's a certain age, we have to expect that occasionally there'll be things that won't work with it.
Ewan Alexander, Dean of the School of Engineering at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.